the past, before you came to practice, did you ever have one of those occasions, or perhaps a few of them, where you found yourself thinking about life and what it was all about? And then you might have had the feeling that the answer to everything was right there on the tip of your tongue. And then just as you were about to reach out for that answer, it was gone. And you were left with that strange feeling of, I know there's something more to life, but what is it? As a young child growing up, I would think about life in this way and what its purpose was. I really couldn't understand. What was I doing here? Why was it so painful? Was it like this for everyone? Life seemed so futile, so empty, so confusing. I remember these thoughts as though they happened yesterday, and they continued for quite a long while. So I really couldn't understand the purpose of my existence on this planet. What was it all about? Because I had this strong feeling that I wanted to know what the purpose was. There simply had to be one. It took many years for me to come to find out that there was something greater than this small and painful life that I led. And that something greater was the Dharma. So in the Buddha's teachings, we're told that the proximate cause for faith to arise is suffering. And if we take a look at our own lives and what brought us to the practice, we might see that this is true. It might be the case for us. So in this way, we could say that the suffering that we experience in life, if we use it in the right way, is what helps to turn us towards the Dharma, to begin to question life. What is it all about? And to look for a way to genuine happiness, to true happiness. So the suffering need not be the obvious, heart-wrenching kind of suffering that we're talking about either. It can be a much more subtle form of perhaps just life not delivering for us, of it being kind of hollow and not having much depth to it. So coming into contact with the Dharma shows us the possibility of transcendence, that there is a way to overcome suffering and to have some depth of meaning, true meaning in our lives, wholesome meaning. When we have this recognition, this is the birth of faith arising within us. And it may only be just the first tiny hint of faith, but it's really important to acknowledge it, to recognize it. So of course this understanding doesn't come about immediately. It's more that we get a little bit of an inkling that this practice may hold something for us. And so we want to pursue it further. So we can see then that faith is how the practice starts. It all begins with that tiny spark of faith. If we didn't have any faith, there is no way that we'd be sitting here today. We've been here 2 weeks, and it hasn't been a bowl of cherries, right? It's not that easy. So what is it that brings us here? It's something more than that. It's something more than it being a pleasant experience, because it isn't exactly a pleasant experience. So if we take a deeper look, we'll see that we have some faith in the possibility that this practice holds for us. Sometimes we have to have this pointed out to us, because sometimes people say, faith, oh, I don't have any faith. And they've been sitting here for 2 weeks. So it's there. It is there. So from this first tiny, vulnerable shoot of faith, as we continue with the practice, it grows into a deep-rooted, sturdy, unshakable tree of faith as we continue with the practice, and the deeper wisdoms naturally then begin to unfold. So no one makes you have faith. Once that first spark of faith is ignited and we continue with the practice, it's a natural progression. It begins to grow. Why? Because we see that the practice works. It actually brings results. Or we could also say that we develop a deeper trust in the Dharma as practice unfolds. We may also say that our confidence in the teachings and our ability to do the practice deepens. Or we may use the word devotion. Devotion to Buddha Dharma Sangha. All of these words mean the same thing. Trust, confidence, devotion, faith. I'll use them interchangeably tonight, because in essence they're the same. In most of the Buddhist teachings and the texts, the word faith is used. But often for Westerners, we seem to prefer the word trust, or confidence often speaks to us more. But any one of them can be used. One time, the Buddha was asked by a lay practitioner, what is the origin of suffering and the passing away of suffering? Now this is a very, for me, I found it a very interesting little interchange. So let's imagine that the Buddha has come to town. We're all lay practitioners, just like this person that asked him the question. So the Buddha's in our midst, and one of us lay practitioners asks him this question. What is the origin of suffering and the passing away of suffering? So this is what the Buddha has to say. He says, are there any people in this town who, if they were killed or imprisoned today, you would feel sorrow, pain, or despair? And this lay practitioner says, yes, sir. So the Buddha then says, are there any people in this town who, if they were killed or imprisoned, you would not feel sorrow, pain, and despair? And this lay practitioner says, yes, sir. And the Buddha then asks him, why is it that there are some for whom you would feel sorrow and some that you wouldn't? And this man says, sir, the ones for whom I would feel sorrow, pain, and despair if they were killed or imprisoned are those to whom I am attached and have desire for. And those I don't feel sorrow and despair for if they were to die, these are people to whom I am not attached or desirous. This is very interesting. So the Buddha then says, with this understanding, Headman, you can apply the same principle to the past and the future. Whatever suffering you have experienced in the past and will experience in the future, the cause, the root, has been attachment and desire. Now this is quite an intense example, Now, why did the Buddha decide to use this? He wanted to reach close to home in a way that this person would be able to understand. He actually says to him, I'm going to give you an example that will actually speak to you, reach you, that will have some meaning to you. I'm not going to give you an example linked to the past or linked to the future, but something that's very tangible in your life. And this is the example that he chooses. Because it does speak to us. We know how attached we are to people who are close to us. And people who are not so close to us, of course we do feel something if they're hurt, but not in the same way that we do if we're really close to that person, if it's a member of our family, for example. So the result of the Buddha using this example, this lay practitioner, is filled with faith because he deeply understood the example that the Buddha was offering him. And he bows to him and says, thank you, and you know, with offering the usual gratitude and appreciation for this example, because he came to understand the source of suffering, the origin of suffering, and how it would end. It's through attachment and non-attachment. So this is how the Buddha offers his teachings on many occasions, and the result is more often than not the same. There is a kind of jubilation. Thank you for the teaching. You have brought light into the darkness. You have made upright what was turned over. You have brought a path where there was no path. I go to you for refuge. Now, if we think of ourselves in our own practice, as we're either listening to Dharma talks, sometimes in the midst of a Dharma talk, there's just a sudden aha moment, something really speaks to us, and we feel that sense of connection with the teachings. Or we actually fulfill the instructions. We're sitting here and we actually are able to, for example, connect with the breath. Just one or two or three moments, and we feel the sweetness of that calm, for example. There is that, oh yes, this works. We've experienced something we've never had before. Those are moments of faith. Those are moments of a growing confidence in our ability to do the practice. And it follows with any other scenario in our practice too, where we've seen thinking in the mind, we've been lost in it, we suddenly recognize it, let go, there's ease in the mind. Yes, this practice of mindfulness works. So this quality of faith is the first of 25 beautiful qualities that begin to develop in the mind as we strengthen in our practice. Some of the other qualities that begin to develop are pliability of mind, when the mind is not so stiff. So there's pliability of mind. There's lightness in the mind or buoyancy in the mind. Kindness grows in the mind, tranquility of mind. So these are all beautiful qualities that begin to arise in the mind. Sayadaw Upandita would often, I think every time I've sat with him, he would say, when you come to do a meditation retreat, it's like going to a beauty parlor. But we're becoming beautiful on the inside. Because this is what the Dharma does for us. It beautifies the mind. It lightens the mind, beautifies it, purifies it. But what specifically does faith do for the mind? It functions to clarify the mind. In the same way, for example, if a swimming pool is dirty, you know, sometimes it goes green and then we put chlorine in the water and magically it becomes clear. Faith does the same thing for the mind. It serves to clarify the mind so that we're not dubious about the teachings and what they offer. We're really clear. So we have a sense of direction when there's faith in the mind. We have some degree of understanding about what we're doing. We know what we need to do. So it manifests as non-fogginess in the mind. We have the sense of purpose. And we could say then that we have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And we're not talking about a blind faith either. The Buddha said that this was really unhealthy. He had a very grounded approach to the practice. There was nothing fanciful or whimsical about his approach to the teaching at all. It was grounded in direct experience. And so he once said to a group of people who were pretty confused about the teachings, because one teacher had told them one thing and another teacher had told them another, and got really confused about the teachings, is just so amazingly simple and pragmatic. So he says to this group of people, all right, when you're lost in aversion, and you recognize this, how do you feel when you're lost in aversion? Does it feel good? No, it feels painful, contracted, hurtful, angry. We've got angry thoughts going on in the mind. He says, and when you've let go of those aversive, angry thoughts, how do you feel then? What's the quality in the mind? Well, it's easeful, it's spacious, it's peaceful. There isn't any suffering. And then he asks the question, well, how do you feel when you're grasping, when there's greed in the mind? Again, you feel contracted, wanting, there's pain. And when you've abandoned that, how do you feel? There's ease, there's peace, there's spaciousness in the mind. He says, well, you can see for yourself which direction does the mind incline in order to feel free from suffering, to experience freedom from suffering. Well, we don't incline towards aversion and greed, and we incline towards letting go. So as we're working with this in our own practice, we taste this for ourselves, just in the tiniest moments. And it's very important for us to acknowledge these very small moments that arise of freedom when we have let go. Because in the bigger picture, it's not such a small moment. If we look at the very big picture of lifetimes, where we've just more than likely been grasping lifetime after lifetime, in this life, when we let go just for a moment, having understood what the teachings are, we know the experience of that sense of ease, of that spaciousness in the mind. And this allows for confidence to grow within us. Sometimes, as the practice is unfolding for us, especially in the first few years, this may happen. We come to practice, we do a little practice, we get some instruction and a bit of understanding, and then we think, ah, I've got it. I've got it down pat. I know what to do. I know all the answers. Then we practice for a little while, and oh, suddenly we see, actually, we don't know it all. We don't have all the answers. Practice a little bit more. Now I've got it. Now I've got all the answers. Right, now I know what to do. And there can be many of these cycles where we think we know what it's all about, and then, oh, we don't know what it's all about. But really what's happening over this phase, this period of time, is that it's the slow breaking down of the rigid mind. The mind that has its own opinions and conclusions about the practice. And this is a rigid mind that holds fast to its ideas about, I know, I've got it, I'm right, I know. So you can feel that the mind that has this tight lid of me and what I know on top of it is a mind that doesn't have very much space in it. It's tight, it's contracted. There's no room for it to expand. So its ability to experience its vastness is very limited. It can't taste its own purity, its own spaciousness. Sometimes, too, something else can unfold as practice continues for us. We can come to a place of not knowing what to do in the practice. We can feel quite lost. And this can come about after we may have been practicing for many, many years. Suddenly, we may come upon deep, painful mental states that we've never experienced before. Or it might be that some serious illness comes upon us, very serious illness. Or it might be some serious physical disability. So we've been practicing for many years, and suddenly something like this comes upon us. And we have no idea how to deal with it in our practice. We feel quite lost. Everything seems to have fallen apart in our practice. We had not considered that something like this might come about in the practice. So here we can see our limitations arising, where somewhere deep within us in the mind, we had an idea of where the practice was going to be going. And we didn't even know that that idea was in there until this either deeply painful mental state or illness or physical disability arose within us. So it's as though we've suddenly hit unfamiliar territory in the mind, and we just do not know where to go. How do we deal with this new and strange experience? So there really can be twists and turns like this for us on the path. Quite unexpected. And we're not new to practice. We've been practicing for a long time. For some of us, when we hit this, you could call it a dark place in our practice, it's a kind of a painful realization that we just don't know what to do anymore or where to go in the practice. It's a very good and important place that we've reached in our practice. The so-called dead end, you might call it, where we thought that the practice was all neat and tidy and went along like this in this straight and narrow path. When we come to this painful place in the mind, as I say, it's a really good place, because it's as though only now are we ready in a way to be brought to our knees. Only now are we ready to surrender, to give over completely to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So it's as though we're only now ready to open and receive the Dharma at a much deeper level than we were able to in the past, prior to this difficulty arising. It's as though we're open and willing to let the Dharma in. This actually is the mind of I don't know anymore, but it's not the I don't know of confusion. It's the I don't know of not having any opinions. All of the opinions we had about what we thought was right and wrong and good and bad and all the things about the practice, that's all dropped away. So you can feel that the mind is vast and open at this place. It's open and ready to receive the Dharma at a much deeper place, that I say. So it's not looking for a specific answer anymore to fit into its old theory of what it knew about the practice, what it thought the practice was. It's now wide open and trusting. There's a deep trust, a giving over, and ready to receive the Dharma. So you can feel the difference in how vast this mind is, as opposed to the mind that has concluded that it knows exactly how things are going to unfold. The one has this tight lid on top of it, and the other one is vast. This vast mind too, when it's reached this place of being brought to its knees, so to speak, it's also a mind that's humble in its recognition of suffering and its willingness to open to whatever is necessary for freedom to come about. But not as a project, not as some kind of an accomplishment, like adding a notch to our belt, so to speak. It's not like that at all. As I say, it's more a giving over, a surrendering to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, as opposed to taking the teachings for ourselves. So there's a very different feel. It's as though there's been a breaking down of our defenses, so to speak. So you can feel we're wide open and ready to receive. There's a deep trust that's there at that time. The act of bowing is very, very helpful in terms of supporting our giving over, our surrendering to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And I'm not actually talking about a literal bow. Some of us literally bow when we come into the hall here. We stand and bow, but it can also be an inner bow, where the heart is sincerely giving over to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. That's the kind of bow that I'm referring to, surrendering from within, from that place of sincerity. In the earlier days of my own practice, when I would do my bows, I would have this image of me taking out my heart and offering it to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It would arise in my mind. Now you might say, well, Annie, really, that's a little bit dramatic. It is a bit dramatic, I must admit. But really what I'm trying to convey is the attitude of heart there. It's that I'm trying to express in this kind of graphic image of taking out the heart and offering it to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So if we take that image for a moment, taking out the heart and offering it to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and we condense that image into a drop of sincere trust. But it's an unconfined drop. And by unconfined, I mean it's a drop that has no edges. So it's a vast and limitless drop of trust. We're just there with that feeling of trust when we give over to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And from that place, we're able to receive. And this is, it's not an ecstatic feeling, some kind of high feeling that we're conjuring up at all. Nothing like that, nothing exuberant. It's just a quiet, grounded, sincere connectedness. That's all it is. There's a story sometimes told in, I think it's the Tibetan tradition, about two monks who were doing a particular practice of bowing, full-length bows, together with a chant. And the one monk very quickly learned this chant in whatever foreign language it was, and he was very good at doing his bows very quickly, full-length bows. He could do lots of them. But the other monk was very slow, but he was also very sincere. And we're told that it was the slow and sincere monk that came to the deepest understanding of the Dharma. So you see this quality of sincerity really is an, plays an important part connected to our feeling of trust in the teachings. So we can use the word devotion, trust, faith, confidence, whatever word we use, it really is an important aspect in our practice, because it really helps for us to see the practice through, to continue with the practice through thick and thin. It's also particularly helpful in times of difficulty. That's what we rest on in times of difficulty in our practice. Our trust, our faith, our confidence that these teachings will carry us through no matter the difficulty that we may come upon. So the Buddha would talk about how rare and important it was for a Buddha to arise in the world, and he would do this many times. Not, of course, because he was, you know, saying how wonderful he was or great he was. Really, it was to allow for this quality of faith to be instilled in the monks, because he knew that it was important for the unfolding of their practice. One time he spoke about the wilderness in the heart. And he said that this wilderness in the heart needs to be abandoned. And what was this wilderness in the heart? He spoke about it being when there is an attitude of doubtfulness in the heart, then we don't have a sense of ardor and devotion in the practice. When there is uncertainty in the heart, and when we're undecided and lacking in confidence, then we don't have this quality of ardor or devotion in us. But these qualities begin to be abandoned as we continue with the practice. That is the operative word. The continuing with the practice allows for our trust, our confidence in the practice, to begin to grow. So we might consider our connection to our teachers. This is also a very helpful support for us in terms of our faith growing. I found this very helpful for me in my own practice. Reflecting on my teachers, bringing my teachers to mind, wherever I was in the world, because of course I lived in another country. And I would bring my teachers to mind, and I would find them very, very helpful for the continued unfolding of my practice. Whenever I found myself in times of difficulty in my life or feeling down, if I brought my teachers to mind, it would help for me to keep going, to allow for the practice to continue. So wherever we may be, even if we're on the moon, if we can bring our teacher to mind, that can help for us to feel supported in the practice, for it to continue to unfold. If we have a strong connection or faith in a teacher, funny things can also begin to unfold for us that allow for the teachings to deepen. For example, one time in the very early days of my practice, Joseph came out to South Africa. This was the second time he had come out to South Africa, so I was already had this strong connection with him. So this was in the very early 80s, and I had remembered on the first 10-day retreat, in those days it was very much about creeping around and lift, move, place, and you know, everything was very, very slow. So I duly had, you know, learned. I was a very diligent practitioner, and you know, a lot of faith in him, so that's how I was doing my practice. And then he came for the second 10-day retreat, which was 2 years later. And again, he was, you know, giving us these instructions, and he had particularly given instructions around eating. You know, you take the spoon in your hand, and then you slowly move it towards the bowl, and then it's, you know, then it's in the bowl, and it's lifting, and it's in the mouth, and it's chewing. Okay, these were the instructions. Happy with the instructions. Then it came time for lunchtime, and we're all having lunch in the same room. Joseph was there as well, sitting up just over there, a few tables away. And I happened to look up at Joseph, and gosh, there he was, eating quite normally, eating away and right then, I got it. You know what I got? Mindfulness can be there at any pace. I don't have to eat really slowly to be mindful. I could eat like Joseph, because he was being mindful, and eating at a normal pace. And so it was from that moment on that I began to explore working with being mindful at a more normal pace. Of course, I didn't succeed then. I still haven't succeeded now. It's a work in progress. But just through looking at Joseph, I have no idea whether he was mindful at all. I have no idea. But because of my faith in him, oh yeah, you can be mindful at any speed. And that's how it began to be instilled within me. So, you know, sometimes we can look at our teacher and they can blow their nose and we can get a teaching. So it's when we have a connection with a teacher, that's how it can sometimes be for us. Of course, a connection with a teacher takes time. We don't connect like that with everybody. So it's not to expect that each teacher we come across we're going to have this strong connection with. It's not many teachers that this happens with. And two, it takes time. It needs to grow and develop with time. Quite a number of years ago, and I was very early 90s, I was planning to do my first three-month retreat. And so I duly looked in the Insight magazine of that time. It was a little different to its design of today. And when I paged through the magazine, the only thing I wanted to take a look at were the dates of the three-month retreat. Because as far as I was concerned, I knew exactly who the teachers were. And here you can see, I had the conclusion. I knew who the teachers were. Because I had looked for the previous few years and it had been the same teachers. I knew two of them, Sharon and Joseph. I had a lot of trust, a lot of confidence in them. And so I wasn't interested in the teachers. I knew who they were going to be. It was only the opening day and the closing day of the retreat that I was interested in. So I page to the Insight magazine. I get to that place and I'm looking at the dates. And my eye just happens to catch the name of the last person on the list of teachers. Just through the corner of my eye, I see a name there. It was an unfamiliar name, a name I had never seen before in the Insight magazine, the last name on the list of teachers, and it was Steve Armstrong. I was immediately suspicious. Who was this person? I'd never heard of him. I didn't even like the look of his name on the page. I decided I didn't like this person. I made my decision. I'm not working with this teacher. Can you see how narrow, how tight, how restricted, how dismissive an attitude like this is? There's no room for a heart mind like this to be open, to expand, to receive, to discover. No room for any possibility of faith or confidence to develop when the heart is shut down and dismissive like this. Let alone any wisdom. There's just no possibility. There is a happy ending to this story, though. As it turns out, somehow the universe tends to do this to us quite often. I did happen to work with Steve Armstrong on a few of my three-month retreats. It just happened that way. And I felt very, very blessed for that opportunity. Because over the years that I began to work with him, that I worked with him, I developed a very deep trust and confidence and an appreciation in his style of teaching and just his way of being. I learned so much from him. In truth, I know that I wouldn't be sitting here today offering the Dharma if it wasn't for Steve. He was one of a few teachers that played an important part in the development of my practice. So I have much gratitude for him, and also much gratitude for how things happened to unfold. Because had I stayed with that dismissive, limited approach and not been willing to explore, who knows where things would be today. So that just shows, you know, where we come up with an idea, an opinion, before we've tested the waters. It's just, can we be just open, a little bit open, to explore first? On the other hand, of course, there are times when we actually don't connect with a teacher. You know, our energies are different, our styles are different. Different aspects of different teachers speak to us. So it's not that we want to force anything, but rather if we don't have a connection with the teacher, rather than condemning that teacher, can we use whatever we see in that person as a means to develop wisdom and compassion, rather than condemning them? There's always something we can learn from them. Even if we don't ever speak to them, just by seeing them, there's something that we can learn from that person. Sometimes in our life, we can feel like we're running out of time. Sometimes we can feel the aging process kicking in quite strongly. And it's possible that we might feel perhaps a little disappointed in ourselves. Perhaps that we haven't come to the practice earlier on in life, or perhaps that our practice hasn't developed in the way we would like it to have developed, or perhaps that we've missed out on something in the teachings. If something like this arises for us, really this is another occasion for us to feel that trust in the Dharma deep within us. Can we feel a trust in the Dharma and the process of its unfolding? On the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, it's said that when he gazed out at the world of sentient beings, he saw that we were all like lotus blossoms at various stages of growth in a pond. He saw that whilst some of us were like the blossoms at or near the surface of the pond, ready to understand the deepest teachings very quickly and become enlightened, whilst some people were like that, most of us who encountered the Dharma were like the lotuses deep below the surface of the water. These lotuses benefit from the sun and the energy that it provides, bringing energy into those lotuses deep below the surface. And it allows for them to sustain their growth, growing slowly, taking a long time to reach the surface of the water and blossom. He says that so too, the majority of people who develop faith in the Dharma through hearing the teachings, the majority of people need to nurture the teachings slowly, with time, taking them in just at a pace that works for each of us, allowing the teachings to grow and mature within us, so that as time unfolds, the deeper wisdoms begin to unfold within us too. So we can see that this requires a tremendous amount of faith, a tremendous amount of trust in the Dharma, trust in the unfolding process of the Dharma. If we fulfill all that the teachings require of us, working with all aspects of the teaching, then we know that this is all that we need to do. This is what's required of us. Just to do the teachings, do the practice, a step at a time. Because the rest really isn't up to us. So anything more than that, anything more than simply doing the practice, really it's a hindrance to our unfolding. So if there's the wondering if, when, how soon, and what else we can do to speed up the process, really that's just worry and agitation. So we put it down. We relax and really give ourselves just to this moment. The one that's past is already gone. The one that hasn't come yet hasn't been born. So can we settle back and just be here with this moment? Because really there isn't anywhere else to be. There is only this moment. Many of us live busy lives out in the world. Perhaps we have families, jobs, homes to tend. And it's possible that sometimes we might feel that we've lost touch with the Dharma in one way or another. So this is another opportunity for us to strengthen our trust in the Dharma, our trust in the process of the Dharma too. Because we can recognize that right then, in that moment, wherever we may be in our daily lives, the Dharma can be awakened right there too. Whatever may be unfolding for us in our lives. Sometimes we just need to be reminded of this. And this is not some poetic sounding cliche that we've heard all too often in our practice. It's only that if we see it in that way, if we can really use these words, seeing the truth of them, and use them to our benefit, then we really can use whatever is offered to us in life as part of the practice. We really can see it in that way. It's also not always possible for us to go and see our teachers at any time we would like to, or to go on a retreat at any time we would like to either. So when we have that sense of longing that may arise within us, longing to maybe see our teacher or to go on a retreat at some time, can we use the sense of longing to touch the Dharma as a means for us to tap into the Dharma, perhaps feeling that sense of gratitude towards our teachers, appreciation for the support that they have given us over the years. And who knows where a reflection like that can lead us. Reflecting in that way can often lead us to take steps that will really push us forward on the path to liberation, in whatever way that may speak to us, whatever needs to be done for each of us as individuals. Trust in the Dharma, in the unfolding process of the teachings, can actually manifest in very individual ways for us too. For example, perhaps we're sitting outdoors, out in nature, on a warm, sunny afternoon. That certain pregnant feeling that we get in the air sometimes in the afternoon when it's warm. We're sitting out there, peaceful, quiet. Then a niggling thought arises. There must be something I need to do. This experience isn't quite right. Something's not quite right in my life. There must be something I have to do. The this feeling just is not it. Then the understanding comes. We realize that we can simply be there with the ordinariness of the moment, just being there on the earth with that moment as it is. We see that there's nothing to fix, there's nothing to change, that everything is perfectly okay as it is, and knowing it as it is. In moments like these, a deep trust in the truth of awareness in the moment can arise within us. In that moment, we really deeply know that there is absolutely nothing we need to do other than connect with this simple present moment. We really know this deep within us, that this is all we really need to do. So when there is this deep trust in the awareness that is already there, that we simply need to reconnect with, when there is this deep trust in awareness, wherever we may be, the Dharma will show itself to us. So let's sit together for a moment or two.